Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, what does it mean for Pennsylvania and the nation's future after census figures show a slowly growing population? But up front, it's not often that a disagreement over who makes the high school cheerleading team makes its way to the United States Supreme Court. But that's just what has happened. It's especially noteworthy because the case is considered one of the most significant free speech arguments in decades. The case was brought by a 14-year-old high school cheerleader, Brandi Levy, from Mahanoy City in Schuylkill County. A freshman on the junior varsity cheerleading team, Brandi failed to win a spot as a varsity cheerleader for the following year. So that weekend, she was frustrated and upset, and off campus, Brandi took a photo of herself and a friend flipping the bird to the camera. She then typed the words at the center of the dispute, F school, F softball, F cheer, F everything. After a team coach saw the post, Brandi was suspended from the team for the rest of the year. But in the meantime, she and her parents challenged the suspension in court, contending that the Mahanoy City School District had no right to discipline Brandi for her off-campus speech. A federal appeals court agreed, ruling that the school could punish her only for speech on campus or at school-sponsored activities. As I said, one of the most significant cases, free speech cases, in years. Joining us, kind of like a legal 101 today, Michael Domino, professor of law with Widener University Commonwealth Law School. Mike Domino, always good talking with you.
Hello, Scott. Always good talking to you as well.
If you have a question or comment, like to weigh in on this case, we're going to be talking about some other issues having to do with the Supreme Court as well. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we're at SmartTalkWITF. Again, this, the phone number is 1-800-729-7532. So, Mike Domino, why is this case so significant?
There are very few Supreme Court cases dealing with the rights of public school students. And this case is different from all the rest because it involves speech that occurred off campus, not involving a school-sponsored activity. And that's really what's at the heart of this dispute. The school is saying we can regulate any student's speech as long as it has an effect on school. And this Instagram post, Snapchat post, had an effect on school by degrading team morale and so forth. Whereas the student says, you can regulate student speech and conduct on school grounds and in school activities, but not when I'm at home, not on the weekends, not after school hours. You should be able to regulate students only when they're students at your school and not all of their lives, just because there might be some kind of effect felt through social media.
All right, so let's talk about both sides of the argument and maybe some repercussions as well. She was off campus. It was a Saturday, so it was off hours. Why should the school have any right to discipline?
My own personal opinion is that they shouldn't. I think the student has the better side of the argument in this case. But the school's argument is that we have a responsibility to protect the functioning of the school, to protect the ability of other students to have a well-functioning learning environment. We have an ability to protect the functioning of this cheerleading team. And to the extent that she goes by her initials in the court case, to the extent that BL's post undermines the functioning of that cheer team, the school is saying that you have behaved in such a way as to call into question whether you have the right kind of attitude, mindset, and comportment to be a member of this team.
But she directed her criticism, and she did it in, you know, a way that was expletive filled. She directed her criticism at the school. So shouldn't the school be able to respond in some way, even if it was off campus and off hours?
That's the school's argument. The school is saying that that this was school-directed speech. It was addressed to members of the cheer team, that some of the friends who received this Snapchat post were other students and other members of the cheer team. And it was the content of the speech referred to the school. So they, on the other hand, the content of the speech was not terribly specific. It wasn't anything that that was defamatory. It wasn't anything that was private. It was a girl blowing off steam. And the members of the Supreme Court in the oral argument, a great many of them seemed to indicate that this was an overreaction by the school. This is to suspend her from the team for an entire year, even if it turns out to have been within their power. It seems to be a poor exercise of judgment.
You know, Mike, one of the things that many legal cases come down to is there probably is a line and where it is crossed. This case is different in many ways when it comes to free speech and students' free speech rights. Many cases I think of having to do with school students have to do with maybe something that they wrote for the school newspaper or said on the school radio station or something like that. Where is that line? Maybe not just in this case, but in free speech rights for students.
Well, that's exactly what the court is trying to figure out in this case. They did have a case involving a school newspaper quite a few years ago, and the court said that if it's the school newspaper, then the school can exercise some editorial control over the content of that school newspaper. And you guys, your audience tends to be unusually well informed about these kinds of issues. So the audience may remember several years ago, there was the Bong Hits for Jesus case, where a student at the Olympic torch rally unfurled a banner that said "Bong Hits for Jesus," but it was and the student was disciplined for that, and the Supreme Court upheld the discipline. But that was at a school-approved field trip, and so the difference between that case and this case is that while that one was speech made during a school-sponsored event under school control for some extent, this one is, as you said, on Saturday, off school ground, not as part of any kind of school-related activity. And so that's basically the line that the student wants to draw, is between school-sponsored events and non-school-sponsored events, whereas the line that the school wants to draw is between the speech that has an effect on the functioning of the school or on school personnel and that speech which doesn't involve the school at all.
Court has ruled in some previous cases involving students' free speech rights. One that got a lot of attention and set some precedent involved a Vietnam war protest where a student wore a black armband to class and was told, take it off, go home, threatened suspension, that kind of thing. In that case, the court ruled that the student had a free speech right to be able to do that. Is there any precedent in that case that could maybe go to this one?
Yes, that case, Tinker is the name of that case. That is the preeminent school speech case. And the standard that it established was that schools can discipline students for speech if that student's speech creates a material and substantial disruption with the functioning of the school or interferes with the rights of other students. And the school in this case is trying to say that BL's speech did cause a material disruption on the functioning of the school because the students who received the speech were all were concerned about it, and the teacher took it as creating a kind of problem It's not at all clear whether it actually did. It's entirely possible that this case could be decided on the ground that there wasn't enough of a material and substantial disruption caused by the Snapchat in this case to allow the school to restrict her speech. Mm-hmm. But even the Tinker case, as you mentioned, involved someone wearing a black armband to school. And so it involved speech on school grounds to which this case does not involve.
You know, I'm sure that there are a lot of people, you know, what I'm going to say is that a lot of people are trying to establish or look at some parallels here. But let me just say that, you know, as you've pointed out, what is unique about this case is that it has to do with something that occurred off school grounds, off hours, that kind of thing. But there may be some people asking, is this similar to an employer suspending, disciplining, or firing an employee for saying something critical of their employer, maybe on social media?
It's very similar, yes. Now, when you have a private employer, somebody who's not the government, then that private employer has substantial freedom to be able to fire people for their speech. The private employers don't have to protect people's free speech rights. Government employers are different. And so if the government employs someone and then tries to fire someone for that employee's exercise of speech, the government can get in some trouble. There are some restrictions on that. The major restriction is that the government may not fire an employee for free speech unless the speech interferes with the functioning of the government office. In that event, then the public employer is free to fire the employee for the employee's speech. And so the parallel here is that the school wants to be able to say, we should be able to discipline students for their speech, whether it occurs on school or off school, if it has an effect on the educational functioning of the school. Now, one potential difference between the employment context and the school context is that people have the ability to find other jobs than working for the government. But people don't have an option of not going to public school. Many of them don't have an option other than going to public school. And so for the government to come in and mandate that people go to public school and then say that we can discipline you for any of your free speech that might have an effect on the public school is in effect to make the public school the supervisor of that student's speech 24 hours a day.
Interesting case. I want to talk about some Supreme Court reforms that are being studied by the Biden administration in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we're going to be talking about answering your questions about coronavirus, as we've done many times over the past year or so. But one of the areas we're going to look at is a lot of people have said they've gotten mixed messages about what they should be doing, what they shouldn't be doing. We'll be talking about some of that on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in. Our guest during the portion of today's program is Michael Domino, professor of law with Widener University Commonwealth Law School. We were just discussing the cheerleader case in Schuylkill County, cheerleader who went on social media and let out a stream of expletives against the school cheerleading squad because she's upset for not making varsity. Supreme Court will hear the case whether the school has the ability, the right to suspend her. But that case will be coming up, and it's being watched very closely. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mike, before we get into the Supreme Court reforms that the Biden administration is looking into, I was reminded of a question when we were just talking about the BL case, as it's referred to. How does the Supreme Court, how do the justices decide what cases they are going to accept? As I said, many people, when they would just see that headline, see cheerleader and girl upset that she didn't make the varsity, would think, oh, what does the Supreme Court really have a role in deciding this? Well, that's not the issue there. It's a free speech issue. But many people may wonder, how does the Supreme Court decide on what cases they're going to hear?
It's a terrific question that people tend not to focus on very much. It's, as one book on the subject says, it's the question of deciding what to decide. The Supreme Court operates with what is called the rule of four. They have nine justices, and as you know, a majority of the justices are required to decide any particular case on the merits, but only four of them are required to accept review of a case. So if people want to bring a case to the Supreme Court and they convince four justices that the case is important enough for their review, then the entire court will hear it. The most important criterion that the court uses for deciding when to accept a case is if the lower courts are conflicted in their answer to a question of federal law. So if the Court of Appeals for the First Circuit and the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit disagree about the answer to a question of federal law, then the Supreme Court will take that case to resolve the conflict and establish a uniform nationwide rule. That's the most important criterion. It's not the only one. Sometimes the court will accept a case just because of its overwhelming importance. But to resolve a conflict among the lower courts is the best indication that the court will grant a writ of certiorari, which means that they will accept review of the case.
All right, I want to move on to something that is related. President Biden has appointed a commission to study Supreme Court reforms. Now, this is a release from the White House. The topics it will examine include the genesis of the reform debate, the court's role in the constitutional system, the length of service and turnover of judges on the court, the membership and size of the court, and the court's case selection rules and practices. Notice I've mentioned the court's case selection. But what has gotten the most attention there, and many people have questioned whether this is the motivation for this commission, is the size of the court. And often court packing is the way it is described, that President Biden may want to increase the size of the court. So what, as a law professor, when you hear that this commission has been appointed, what do you hear?
I think that it's one of two things, I think. Either the Biden administration wants to press a court packing plan and wants the cover of this, what the White House continues to call a bipartisan commission, to provide a reason to go forward. Or the White House has decided it doesn't want to push that that hard, and we'll use this commission as to mollify the left wing of the Democratic Party, to say, I tried out your idea, I suggested your idea, I gave it to these experts, they don't like it, and so we're going to impose other reforms or try for other reforms, but we're not going to alter the number of justices on the court. It is absolutely clear that it is within the constitutional power of Congress and the president to alter the number of justices on the court. There is no constitutional requirement that there be nine justices. And at early parts in our history, there were not. The first Judiciary Act set the Supreme Court at six members. It has gone as low as five and as high as 10, but it has been set at nine for about 150 years. And so to change it from nine wouldn't be unconstitutional, but it would certainly be a break with long established norms.
All right. Breaking with long established norms. Franklin Roosevelt, probably, you know, there are some people who are comparing Joe Biden's bold plans, as they've been called, with Franklin Roosevelt with the New Deal. And Franklin Roosevelt tried to increase the size of the court because at that time he had a similar situation. He had justices that had ruled against some of the things that he wanted to do. He wanted to place some of his own judicial nominees on the court. What happened then? I mean, it was struck down. It continued to be nine people on the court.
Well, yeah, and when you say struck down, it failed in Congress. That even though the Democratic Party, Roosevelt's Democratic Party, had very strong majorities in the House and the Senate, the proposal died in committee and never got off the ground in Congress, because even though the members of Congress and members of the public wanted large portions of Roosevelt's policy agenda, they did not want to achieve it at the risk of undermining the Supreme Court's independence. The question is whether that same attitude toward the Supreme Court is present today, and that's what we don't know yet.
Well, I mean, we have a Republican majority in the Senate, and since everything appears to be political today, there would not seem to be any kind of appetite, at least in the Senate, for making the kind of changes.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, we don't have a Republican majority in the Senate. We have a 50-50 split in the Senate
with
Democratic control.
That's right. Okay.
Right. Now, as it is now, the Republicans could filibuster a move to change the number of seats on the court, but the Democrats in the Senate could use that opportunity to get rid of the legislative filibuster. So they have the raw power to be able to shift the number of justices if they want to pull out all the stops.
I guess I was assuming, and maybe I shouldn't have done that, that it would take a 60-vote majority for something as significant as changing the makeup of the Supreme Court. But as you just brought up, the filibuster is something that could be, and I almost said struck down again. I know that in legal terms, struck down has a connotation of that a court made a decision. Should not have used that term, struck down, when we're talking about Congress. But I mean, the bottom line is that those who are looking at this and are questioning President Biden's motivations are saying that, you know, let's face it, there is a majority conservative justices on the Supreme Court, and that what President Biden is looking to do is to make his plans more acceptable to a Supreme Court. Is it as simple as that?
Well, I don't know what's in President Biden's mind, so I don't know what he's trying to do. But yes, certainly the irritation of some of the people on the left to the Supreme Court's decisions is policy based. It's not just the Biden agenda that they want to get through. They want the Supreme Court to take an attitude towards interpretation of the Constitution and interpretation of other laws that are more friendly to interests that the Democratic Party cares about. So it's not just the Biden administration's agenda, but it is the Democratic Party's overall policy desires, that they see the courts as an obstruction to the achievement of their policy ends, given the more conservative orientation of the courts at present, and they want to get rid of that obstruction.
Let's face it, Mike, appointments to the Supreme Court, judicial appointments, I mean, this has become so political in recent years. Many people would point to when former President Obama nominated Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court, and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader at that time, said, well, we're going to wait until after the election in 2016 to do that. Held on to the nomination, didn't bring it up for an entire year. I mean, politics Is there precedent? Is there history for the kind of politics that we've seen, at least in the nomination process, over the last 10 years or so?
Well, yes. There's. We may be at a particular low point in our country's history with regard to consideration of some nominees, but there's plenty of historical precedent. As I said, the number of justices has altered over time. The first switch from 6 to 5 was an attempt to prevent President Jefferson from getting an appointment to the Supreme Court. And other alterations in the number of justices have been made for similarly political reasons. There have been controversies about other nominees besides ones dating from Garland forward. There were controversies about Abe Fortas's nomination to be Chief Justice at the end of President Johnson's administration. Even though the Democrats controlled the Senate, the Republicans were able to hold that off long enough so that the nomination was able to go to Nixon when he came in 1969. And there were similar controversies about nominations from other presidents. But yes, it tends to be centered on politics. The justices make decisions that are extremely important with regard to American policy, and the members of Congress realize that. And so when the president nominates and when the Senate decides whether to confirm or not, those policy questions are very much on the forefront of everyone's mind.
Well, I guess I'm just thinking about my lifetime as well. Now, I was living during the Fortas thing, but I was just a little tyke at that time. But I go back to Robert Bork. It seems as though that was a turning point in modern judicial appointments, that when President Reagan nominated Robert Bork to the Supreme Court, and there were hearings, and there was Clarence Thomas hearings, that since the Bork hearings, that this all has changed. Live television, 24/7. Of course, we didn't have it up until 1980, but still, that it gets so much more attention politically than what it did before.
I think that's right. And it's the people, the members of the Senate who are deciding whether to support or oppose a nominee. Since Bork, they have been much more open about discussing policy reasons for doing that. That Bork was unquestionably qualified for the court, but his political attitudes struck some Democrats and some moderate Republicans as problematic. And he received a negative vote in the Senate, not because of anything about qualifications or merit or morals or anything like that, but just because they thought that he was too conservative. And since then, we've had that has become something more of the norm. Now, Republicans, there was a substantial number of Republicans who did vote for the appointment of Ginsburg, Sotomayor, Kagan, even Justice Breyer got a positive vote that was overwhelming in the Senate, even though he wasn't all of them nominees of Democratic presidents who were believed to be on the liberal side, but they were qualified and they received positive votes. Nowadays, we see that that's much less likely to be the case, that if you're a conservative, you are really unlikely to get votes of very many at all Democrats in the Senate. And if you're liberal, good luck getting votes of a substantial number of Republicans.
Elizabeth tweets, and she has a point. She said that many people were upset of how the GOP maneuvered to get the current makeup of the court. And in particular, the last nomination just before President Biden took office. And that did have a big impact on the makeup of the court. So there is a point that Elizabeth makes. We have a question here from Bruce, and this goes back to the cheerleading case that we were talking about. I know we're moving around a little bit, but Bruce has got this question in just before we changed our topics here. He wanted to know if it would make any difference if there were pre-established team rules that laid out offenses and penalties, including suspension from the team.
That's a good question, and that was raised in the oral argument. The question was whether if we had a list of offenses or of conduct that was required or forbidden, could the cheerleader be forced to agree to them to enable her to participate on the team? And the assumption seems to be that, yes, that would be okay if you're talking about an extracurricular activity. But a school probably could not do that, or at least there is a dispute about whether a school could do that, for a general student in the school who isn't participating in any extracurricular activity, so isn't agreeing to limit his speech so as to receive some kind of benefit or special opportunity, but instead is just going to school as a regular student. So the answer probably is that, yes, we can come up with additional specific requirements, at least if we're doing it as a condition of some kind of extracurricular program.
Mike Domino, professor of law with Widener University Commonwealth Law School. Nothing like a good Supreme Court discussion to get the blood boiling. Mike, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Be happy to come back anytime.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The 2020 U.S. Census preliminary results are in, and the count showed that Pennsylvania's population growth is not keeping pace with other states and the U.S. as a whole. Pennsylvania is still the fifth most populous, with more than 13 million people. But other states grew faster. But really, the nation's population growth slowed. In fact, there's some breaking news about that that we're going to be discussing in just a few minutes. What's behind the trend, and what do the numbers indicate for the state's future? Joining us is Dr. Hans-Peter Kohler. He's a social and economic demographer with the Population Studies Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Kohler, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Kohler, much of your studies center on fertility and health and economics. Not just Pennsylvania, but the nation's population overall grew slower than it has in decades. Why?
So there is a very broad trend happening of fertility declining. The U.S. over the last couple of years has set record low fertility rates, and that fits in a very broad global picture of many developed countries having declining fertility rate. At the core of this is something that, you know, we might consider a profound restructuring of early adulthood, of children increasingly becoming a choice, children or individuals having children once their relationships and careers are settled. So there's a later pattern of fertility, and often that coincides with fewer children and parents investing more into these children. And so the fertility trends in the U.S. have been declining and are expected to continue to decline. And that, you know, is combined with declining migration rates and, I guess, a slowing progress in extending mortality. And the combined result of these factors has been a, you know, significant reduction in U.S. population growth.
Now, as I said, we have some breaking news about fertility rates or birth rates that I'm going to get to in just a moment. But what you just described of couples having children later in life, having fewer children, is that a social change or is it one that has been dictated by economics?
I think it's combined. So for sure, there's some economic factors contributing to this. Kind of early adulthood is often stressful given the pressures there exist in you know, establishing yourself in the labor market, in finding housing. So there is a set of economic pressures that perhaps have gone up in early adulthood. And then there are also profound social changes that, you know, having children is increasingly seen as a choice, something that you might do if you feel like having children, and not having children is increasingly accepted as a perfectly viable life course decision. And the extent to which individuals make conscious decisions about fertility has really fundamentally changed, where decades ago, the normative pressures from either parents or society at large to enter parenthood and do so relatively early may have been much stronger and resulted in that. And kind of supporting this argument, the kind of declines in fertility are presumably mostly due to the fact that fertility declined at very young ages. So there's been this marked declines in teenage pregnancies, or fertility occurring to very young adults. And there is consistent evidence that a significant part of the decline is due to kind of unwanted or mistimed children, so children that, you know, come at the wrong time, that individuals, that fertility decline is driven by a decline in the number of births that are mistimed or unwanted.
Mm. And here's that news I was talking about. This just out today, the U.S. birth rate has seen its biggest fall for nearly 50 years. The COVID pandemic has accelerated a longer term trend towards fewer births, with the rate dropping to 1.6 children per woman. The U.S. birth rate has fallen 4% in the largest single year drop in nearly 50 years, according to a government report. The rate dropped for mothers of every major race and ethnicity and in nearly all age groups, falling to the lowest point since federal health officials started tracking it more than a century ago. And this was a report that was published today. Now, a lot of that focuses on the past year, and it may be a little bit of a surprise. I mean, you had a lot of people joking, or at least I heard a lot of people joking at the beginning of this pandemic with people stuck at home that there would be a baby boom. Well, that hasn't happened. Actually, as that report just said, there has been a decline in births, a significant decline in births over the past year. So what does that report say to you?
Two components. So this report came out and focuses on the calendar year 2020 and focuses on children that were actually born in 2020. And in kind of late in the year, November, December, we may actually see the impact of, you know, declining birth as a result of the COVID pandemic. But importantly, for most of the birth occurring in 2020, these were pre-pandemic perceptions. So it's important on one hand to recognize that the trend that we see in that report is not predominantly driven by the pandemic. At the tail end, as we reach the birth occurring in November, December, we see these declines that are stronger than expected, and this is the impact of the pandemic. So the upshot here is that I would expect this, you know, decline of fertility to extend well into 2021. And then, you know, there may be a stabilization, a modest turnaround for a little bit. And of once our life goes back to normal, the economic implications of the pandemic settle. And some individuals who might have delayed their, you know, conceptions from 2020 might decide to have children in 2021. And we're going to see these births showing up in late 2021. And early 2022. But the broad picture that we're seeing in this government report is mostly driven by trends that were established and existed prior to the pandemic. For sure, the pandemic reinforced that as we see the end of the year. And my expectation would be that we see this broad picture continuing well into 2021.
You know, I don't want to make light of this, but as I said, there were so many people who joked that there would be a baby boom because couples would be at home, have more time on their hands and that kind of thing. Why would couples decide not to conceive, not to have children during the pandemic?
And this is, of course, a great story. And it, you know, shows up frequently when there is a major blackout that there is this urban myth out there. If people are stuck at home, what they think about doing is making an additional child. But it has been debunked in many contexts. So there's basically no evidence that this ever existed in any major other events. So for most of these blackouts, this has been debunked. The kind of storyline that winning national soccer championships or events along these lines produce baby booms have been debunked. And in the contrary, there's very solid evidence that economic recessions, you know, produce declines in fertility, that kind of increased stress in early adulthood, either due to economic pressures or just kind of fears about uncertainty. You don't know what's happening next in your life. All of these kind of stressors, uncertainties tend to reduce fertility. And if one takes kind of this established evidence into account, it was always a far-fetched claim to argue that there would be this kind of pandemic baby boom, that people stuck at home would go ahead and have children. I think both the, you know, if we look back at the remarkable economic and general uncertainty that existed a year ago, where we really didn't know what was going to happen, both in terms of economy-wise, job-wise, but also much more general in terms of our lives, it's, you know, it's hard to believe that people would say, okay, that's the right moment to make a significant long-term investment where we make a commitment to having a new child, which entails commitment to raising that child, to making significant investments into this child. And, you know, many people probably said, well, maybe that isn't the right time to do this. Let's have the dust settle. And once our lives, our individual lives, and kind of the society, the world in general is more settled, then we might think about having a child. So my thinking is, it's a really great story and it keeps coming up. The evidence supporting it has been weak, and I certainly did not fall into the camp of people who said that this would be the likely outcome of the pandemic.
You realize you just ruined a long-held belief for many people out there. Let's talk about the economy with the economic results of this low fertility rate, low birth rate. What does it mean for an economy like Pennsylvania that has a slowly growing population, and as we've seen, the nation as a whole with a slower growing population?
So there are two aspects to this. On one hand, let's begin with the nation as a whole, where I think, you know, the U.S. and many other developed countries face this prospect of significant population aging. We're going to have a much older population in the future, driven by multiple factors, declining fertility being one of them, kind of extending life expectancies being the other one, and migration playing a role. And on that, there has been a significant revision of what that entails. You know, some time ago, one, two decades ago, there have been this very pessimistic assessments that an aging population will result in lower economic growth, less innovative economy, kind of stagnation. And there's this perception that for a society, it must be inherently bad or disadvantageous if we kind of age and become older. And to a large extent, this has been revised. And population aging proposes a major challenge. We need to revise Social Security, many other programs. They're not sustainable in their current form. But, you know, there is this perception that, or this kind of evidence now, that just becoming an older society is unlikely to threaten fundamentally our well-being. So, you know, the fact that the U.S. is a very wealthy society, that it continues to kind of innovate and progress, well, that's in no fundamental way challenged by population aging. And so from the national perspective, I think the conclusion is it's a major challenge. We need to face it like we need to face many other challenges with appropriate policy responses. But if we kind of face that challenge, respond appropriately, it's not going to fundamentally question our ability to be an affluent, innovative society that supports high levels of well-being for most of the population. Then once you go down to the regional level, the story becomes obviously different. So there is, you know, slower population growth in Pennsylvania, and then driven by migration, there's likely to be a, you know, concentration of population in the more urban centers and kind of rural areas declining. And, you know, and again, while there's some stories out there that pandemic-related migration kind of cause people to move into rural areas, that, you know, might be true to some extent, but probably isn't enough to kind of undo that fundamental trend that population is going to be more concentrated. And there are going to be real challenges and adjustments out there for a state like Pennsylvania to respond to this. And I think what the best responses are is very much an open question. So, you know, cities, regions can obviously try to attract migrants, which is the primary way you can influence kind of short-term local population trends. And that works to some extent, but you know, everybody then is competing with everybody else in trying to attract the same migrants, though there are limits to how far that can go. And I think the other part is then a, you know, fundamental rethinking of how do we, you know, structure kind of our society, infrastructure, our investments in a context where population decline might be a real and sustained future. And, you know, the answer is, I think we're developing globally the right strategies. There's, you know, a set of countries that have been dealing with this for quite a bit longer. So East Germany, for instance, one example, had, you know, very rapidly declining regional populations in East Germany for some time. And we can start looking at how communities have responded. And we might have to look at some of these responses. But anyway, what I'm saying is that's a real challenge and probably not a real good answer out there how to respond to this.
We have about 3 minutes left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. China and India, both nations, the two most populated nations on Earth. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see what's happening right now in India with the large population mm-hmm. and the COVID-19. But what about birth rates in China and India? Have they stagnated or are they growing?
So I think China has had a very low fertility rate now for quite some time. And China, I think, is well on its path to worry a lot more about population aging and fertility rates being too low as the opposite. So in India, I think the story is a little bit mixed, where fertility rates have been declining for quite some time. But then in some areas of India, they have been stagnating. And India is certainly projected to grow significantly more in the next decades.
So when you say that, you know, China's birth rate has been going down, of course, the government probably had a lot to do with that, with dictating, you know, how many children a family could have. But from what I understand, they have lifted some of those restrictions, correct?
Yes, they have lifted that because they're concerned about fertility being too low. And I'm not an expert in this area, but I think it's really kind of questionable, or I think it's the effectiveness of lifting restrictions on increasing fertility rates, I think is very questionable. So kind of, I think that's part of the storyline is that low fertility presumably is fairly embedded in China at this point, that even lifting the kind of one child policy and related restrictions may not immediately translate into a significant increase in fertility.
We got a tweet from Susanna, and she says, as a local home birth midwife, my business has tripled in the pandemic. The babies have not stopped being born. I see far less being born in hospitals. So as far as midwives go, and of course, midwives, I should say, here in central Pennsylvania, we do have a lot of families that go to midwives rather than going to the hospital. So that's just one anecdote that I'll put out there. Dr. Kohler, we only have about a minute or so left. I'm not asking you to comment specifically on these proposals, but President Biden has proposed $4 trillion in spending that counts on people returning to work. And there have been some questions as to whether there are enough workers to actually return to work or to work at all to provide the kind of money that the president is looking for. Do we have enough workers out there?
So, you know, and I really don't know the answer to that specific question, do we have enough workers? But it's also clear that, you know, the answer to this question is determined by the current workers and is kind of independent of fertility trends. So the current workers were shaped by fertility trends 20 and more years ago and by migration. And so the effect of current declining fertility on, you know, future labor market is a few years, you know, decades out in the future. And there the question is, do we have the right combination of people and human capital that can fill the jobs that we're going to have in the future? And my suspicion here would be that declining birth rates are not going to kind of translate into a fundamental job crisis, because the jobs in the future presumably do require fewer people with more qualifications. And one of the implications of lower fertility is that those who have children will invest more into their children, and including in human capital. And the kind of workers of tomorrow.
Dr. Hans Potter, I hate to interrupt, but we're out of time. Dr. Hans Peter Kohler, University of Pennsylvania, thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.